that no is just a delayed version of yes. You just have to keep asking the question other ways.
Helping community leaders grow financially resilient, resource conscious, and people friendly cities is the Go Cultivate podcast, brought to you by Verdunity.
Hey guys, you are listening to the Go Cultivate podcast. I am Kevin Shepherd, and I've got AJ Favre with me here today again. Good morning, AJ, or good afternoon.
Good morning. Afternoon, whatever it is.
Yeah, kind of blends together, right?
Day after a holiday weekend, it's hard to know.
Yeah, we're recording this coming back from a nice Memorial Day weekend. It's kind of refreshing to take a couple days away and think about those who have served. And it's been a pretty crazy week here in Texas with some of the news from Uvalde last week. So kind of it was a nice time for me to kind of reflect and just got away from what we do, but I also thought about ways we can do what we do better. So, mm-hmm. Well, I think I'd like to just kick it to you. This is going to be another interview, AJ, that you've done. Maybe just give a quick overview of who you interviewed here and why you decided to reach out to Jason. And then I've got a couple of thoughts to tee up the interview, and then we'll get it going.
Yeah. So Jason Duff does a lot of really cool small developer work in Belle Fountain, Ohio, where he hails from. He has a similar story to many of us that, you know, grew up in a town that was full of prosperity and opportunity, and watched that town start to die off as changes occurred. And he's one of those people that decided, instead of leaving and going on to find the next best place, that he was going to buckle down and do what it took to try to revitalize his community. He's the kind of person that every community needs. And he and his group, Small Nation, have done some extraordinary work, not only with putting their money where their mouth is. They don't just talk about doing these things. They actually go out and do them, and have done some excellent examples of a variety of different kinds of redevelopment work. But they're also working hard to cultivate that same type of spirit and entrepreneurial drive at a local level in their part of the Midwest. So it seemed like a great opportunity to highlight someone doing this same type of work in another part of the country. I had come across an article that Jason was quoted in from a source that I read often, and was really impressed with his story, and really wanted to give him the opportunity to share that story with our listeners. So I think it is a pretty well-rounded conversation. We cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time, and I think it's very inspiring and thought-provoking, and I hope our listeners will feel the same way.
Yeah, I found it a really good discussion. And if you're interested in things like the incremental development that we've had Monty Anderson on in the past, and you would like to hear a different voice talking about how to make something like that happen, if you're interested in downtown revitalization, another topic that AJ, you just had just talked about earlier this season, this interview gets into a lot of those things. But probably the biggest takeaway is that it's all about local bottom up. You know, I really liked how he talked through the steps of how he first got engaged with buying a building, and just those very first steps to activate his downtown. And it's something that I think anybody can do. You know, you may or may not have the resources to buy a building and do it to the level that Jason did, but you can certainly be part of connecting those dots and doing some of the different steps that he talked about. So I've got a couple other thoughts I want to share, kind of his takeaways on the back end of this, but let's just jump right into AJ's interview with Jason Duff.
So Jason, welcome to the Go Cultivate podcast. I'm very excited about doing this interview with you. And for the benefit of our listeners, I read an article in the Daily Yonder, which is one of my favorite things to hit my inbox every week. And there was an article about your work in Ohio. And I knew when I read it that our listeners would love to hear your story. So you and your team, Small Nation, has done a lion's share of work. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. But in summary, I noticed on your website, it says you've renovated over 56 historic buildings. You've launched 17 specialty retail stores, 7 eateries, 3 event centers, and 34 loft apartments. I'm tired reading that. Excellent local example of the type of incremental grassroots local type of development that we at Virginity really encourage our client communities to embrace. And that sounds like an unbelievable community impact that I want to get into with you. So to give our listeners a little bit of background, you're a lifelong resident of a small city, around 13,000 people, who had kind of watched your hometown go through the same cycle that we hear from so many of our clients. From this bustling and active place that struggles to kind of weather that blow of national retailers coming in and setting up shop nearby. And then over time, that downtown gets really silent. But you decided to do something about it. And in the process, it has rebounded and you found your calling of helping others reclaim their small towns. It's absolutely incredible. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, AJ, for having me, and really appreciate the generous introduction. A little bit about my background. I'm a product of a third generation family business. So both of my parents and grandparents, they owned small businesses in my hometown, in my community. And my dad had businesses in construction materials. We sold lumber, concrete, and stone. And my mom had a Hallmark shop. So I joke with others, they're like, how did you get your first loan to buy a historic building? And I tell them that my mom paid me in Beanie Babies. I'm cashing out on that Beanie Baby collection. No, I wish that was the case. But the story of Bell Fountain is very similar to small towns that are peppered all across the country. We were known 120 years ago as a destination for transportation, because it was an intersection for the railroads. As the railroads were expanding west, Ohio was kind of the new frontier for manufacturing. Bell Fountain had a roundhouse that would work on locomotives. And because of that industry, this town had an incredible amount of historic building stock. It also had a lot of industry with seeing products that were manufactured and made in the town. At one point, we had a Hearst company in Bell Fountain called Miller Meteor. And what I share for any 80s kids that may be listening to the podcast today, if you remember the movie Ghostbusters, the Ecnomobile actually was manufactured in Bell Fountain, Ohio, the town that we're working in.
Oh, wow. So, that's a great tidbit.
You know, and I think that what I love when I connect with other community developers, mayors, county commissioners, one of the first things I do is I say, tell me about your town and what makes it unique. And I think that's something for all of us, that history of what the points of pride that we all know and love, if you're from the area, really igniting and using that as a tool as you rethink of how you're going to redevelop for the future. But you know, growing up in that family business environment, my mom had one of her Hallmark shops in the downtown. And while Bell Fountain was the county seat, I was grew up in a town much smaller outside of the county seat. And in what you find kind of in these smaller communities, whether it's the school districts, there's rivalries, there's politics. And sometimes like that can be a big barrier too to seeing development because everyone gets that siloed mentality. But my interaction with Bell Fountain, while it wasn't my hometown or my school where my school was, my mom had a store here. And so when I would go into work in her store, I would walk the streets and many of the business owners that were in the downtown became people that were impactful in my life. So the men's clothing store, Huber Buckenroth, that had been here for 70 years, the owner of that business, when I was 13 years old, taught me how to tie a tie. And there were certain life experiences that meant a lot to me. And then you know, fast forward, 10, 20 years from growing up, I went off to college like a lot of other folks. When you graduate high school, the first thing you want to do is like leave where you grew up or where you're from. And there really wasn't a lot of things at the time keeping someone like me here, working here or living here or starting a business here. So that time that I went away, a lot of things changed in the downtown. The big box pharmacies came and purchased the independents. our department stores that we had at the time closed. And even my mom's shop, the years of selling collectibles, the things that we packed full in curio cabinets, consumer trends changed. So our downtown ended up being, in a period of about 4 to 5 years, 80% of the first floors of our spaces were vacant and empty. And that actually had a much deeper impact on the community. I mean, you can look at things like statistically, like employment numbers. You can look at the amount of tax revenue, both for income tax and property taxes. Like, everything started to be depressed. And then there's the things that are more qualitative, in the aspect of the energy and just the weight that pressure put on of why would you want to stay here, live here, and do business here?
Mm-hmm. That sounds so similar to what a lot of us have experienced personally, and the stories we trade with people that we're working with. So very, very timely. So as a pro podcaster, as I consider myself, you notice what I did there. I let you pronounce the name of the town for me, so I didn't get it wrong, because in Texas, we have this thing where we can pretty much smell somebody who is not from these parts pretty quickly, mm-hmm. based on how they pronounce the name of the town. So thank you for doing that. So can you talk a little bit about your first kind of catalytic project that kicked it all off, and kind of summarize some of the high points of the project work you've done to date?
So the first project really began with me deciding that after graduating college, and I'll back up a little bit, I explained that my parents were small business owners. Really no one in my family ever pursued getting an education, a college degree. It was kind of expected that when you graduate high school, you go to work. But I had a music teacher in middle school and high school that said, Jason, you have talent and you've got some abilities that I think if you auditioned at a university, you could get a scholarship. And so if you want to flip out your very traditional conservative small business parents, you tell them you're going to go to a liberal arts college and you're going to be a music major. So I did that. And I'm really happy I did that, because, as a shy kid growing up, I didn't really have the confidence to speak in front of other people, let alone be on a stage. But those skills at the university of being able to be around mentors and being able to be away for a little bit gave me a fresh perspective and energy to come back to want to change my town. So the first project is I started seeing all these empty buildings in our town and remembering 10, 15 years ago when there was life and energy and wanting to be a part of solving the problem. So I joined some of the boards and committees that existed in our community. The Main Street program was just getting up on its feet, and fresh out of school, lots of new ideas, lots of ways that I want to change the community. I got involved in the promotions committee. So the promotions committee, if you think of the Main Street approach, which is really kind of the theory over the last 40 years that has transformed a lot of towns throughout the country and around the world. It really is built on kind of four pillars: is how do we focus on events and promotions? How do we work on economic restructuring and economic development and the tools and incentives that are aligned around that? And then how do we get the organization set up? So from a governance standpoint, is there a board of directors? How are we focused on fundraising? How are we hiring potential staff? And then the last piece is design. So what are those design standards that we want to accomplish for the town when people do renovate their buildings? What are the things that are going to matter that are going to really have that aesthetic that represents us? So that's the theory. And what was great of joining as a volunteer with that, I was going to other trainings and events to learn about how other towns have been successfully redeveloped their main streets and their downtowns. Well, here's what happened. 2005, 2006, we were recognized as a national Main Street community. There was lots of momentum and conversations amongst the board and the committees. But when the economic crisis really hit Ohio and hit our country and our town, we lost our public funding. So we lost the piece of our budget that was a substantial amount to maintain our executive director. when we lost our executive director, we were not nationally certified anymore, which to some communities, that would have been kind of the death knell. There is no way we are charting for it. But for me and a few other of the volunteers, we said, we're going to take what we learned and we're going to move things in the action phase and go do. And for me, that was buying a historic building right across in our square, right across from the courthouse. The main street in our town had 14,000 cars a day. And either very naive or brilliant, I bought a building at a sheriff's sale for a very little amount of money. It wasn't necessarily a dollar, but it wasn't $10,000. It was a very low amount of money to acquire the building. But the piece of real estate at the time, when it would rain, there was this beautiful water feature in the middle of the building. Basically, the hole in the roof would allow for all three floors of water to trickle down to the basement. And then if you're someone that appreciates quality artwork, the mold that would form on the walls, I mean, all the colors of the rainbow. And if you haven't seen like yellow mold and pink mold, like it was an artist couldn't create this. So for me, I'm always someone that really looked at and can see the potential. And I think for a lot of towns, the struggle for the investor, the struggle is for the community. It's like that building should be boarded up. Mm-hmm. Bricks are falling off of it. It's a money pit. There is no way. It'd be better to make that a parking lot. I have never looked at things that way. Like, I am the person that goes to a town, to their antique mall. I will sift through the historic postcards in that antique mall to see what the glory days of your town was and the history and the stories and the businesses that are there. Because that's how my mind is wired. And so I try to teach that mentality and those examples to others. But this building, it was three stories. It was 12,000 square feet right across from the courthouse. Beautiful orange brick, a cornice on top, and then large storefront windows. But it lacked a business. And when I would survey and talk to people in the towns, like, what do you think we're missing? The thing that would come up very high in those conversations was a destination restaurant. Like, mm-hmm. We want a restaurant that is sit down, is a great place for people to meet and to convene, and a place we can grab a drink. Like, a lot of people had ideas, but there really wasn't anyone easily that I knew of that was raising their hand to come to downtown Bell Fountain to lease and to open a restaurant. So what I did is I acquired the real estate. I started working on things like the little things that I could do. You know, the storefront windows that were, you know, clouded and boarded up, I cleaned them. I started, you know, making sure the sidewalks were free of debris. I then worked with the electric to get the electric back on and just light up the windows at night. So when you drive by, there was energy, there was life, at least as people knew that, oh, there's this kid at the time that's come into our town. He wants to make the town better. It was matching that perception with reality. And I think that's another thing. A lot of people will promote and say, we're going to do all these really big things. When if they just start out with the small things and take action on those incremental steps, then people start to believe in you and want to also say, we can help out, or we want to clean up our neighboring property next door, or you know, another vacant building that may be there. But how do you recruit that destination restaurant? This is really the 3-minute commercial nugget that listeners today can go take action on and do. And I started researching within 45 minutes of my town, who were those entrepreneurs, restaurateurs that were creating awesome experiences that really love getting up every day and making their product, serving their customers, and they want to do more of it. And we had a pizzeria that was about 45 minutes away from Bell Fountain that the founder was recognized as being a world pizza champion. He would compete in competitions. He was actually an acrobatic performer with dough and would go out and just accomplish all these amazing things. But not only was it entertaining and not only was he bringing back these awards, the pizza, the product tasted amazing. And so my first reach out was really driving up in his restaurant, being a customer, getting to know him. And just my first thing was I said, Michael, would you ever consider opening up a pizzeria in another town? And he, you know, pondered a little bit, but very quickly was to answer the question and saying, no. And this is the theme when I talk with others, like, you know, you'll hear the word no a lot in your life. And, you know, I left that conversation a little disappointed, but I went back and I, again, was looking at all the Facebook reviews for his business. I was seeing, you know, just how his story, like I actually did more research on him as a person, how he got started, the values behind his business. So I went back up a few weeks later, ordered another pizza. He happened to be right across the counter in the kitchen, still doing his magic. He came out and said, what do you think of this pie? And I'm like, this is, again, some of the best pizza I've ever had. Oh, by the way, I've got this binder of pictures of this property in Belle Fountain. Look at these 10 ceilings. Can you believe there are 14,000 cars a day that pass by this property? You know, just doing a little bit of a sales pitch to him to put it on his radar. And my next question was, would you consider coming to Belle Fountain? He said, no. Well, another mentor said that no is just a delayed version of yes. Mm-hmm. You just have to keep asking the question other ways. I went back another few weeks, and when I was in his restaurant, I happened to look table to table, and I was stopping and talking to many of the guests in there. He came to me and said, how do you know so many people in my restaurant? And I said, well, because they're all driving 45 minutes to eat your product. The problem was with Belle Fountain, Ohio, it was a food desert. We lacked great places to eat. We lacked great places to shop. The town was viewed as an underrated town because it didn't have all those quality of life amenities that so many other towns that we would drive to go experience would. Here's what it did have. It had incredible historic building stock. So after Michael kind of recognized that, he came down, took a tour, introduced me to his mentee, Brittany Saxton. Brittany was 14 years old at the time that started working for him. She became a line cook, a pizza chef, an assistant manager. Today, you fast forward to today, the pizzeria that opened up in our town, 600 downtown, Brittany is the owner of that pizzeria. She is a five-time world pizza champion. She's been on the Food Network twice, and she was recognized in the White House in 2017 for being and expanding her business to build Bellavino Events and Wine Room using an opportunity zone. She is an entrepreneurial force in our town, and that project, that one pizzeria, was the catalyst to really get everything going for my company and also for downtown Belle Fountain.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So from your experiences doing this, your persistence, your passion, the idea for Small Nation grew. And your website is very clear about your purpose. And I encourage our listeners to look in our show notes. We've given you a link to the website, but it reads very simply, we exist to help small towns, small businesses, and small business investors learn to take control of the down and turn it around. What inspired you to do this, and how has it been received?
Well, when we first shared that another pizzeria was opening up in the building in the downtown, you can imagine the negativity that came from that. First off, people would say, we already have 13 other pizza places in downtown Belle Fountain. There's no way another one's going to work. Why are they going downtown? There's no parking. You know, the common naysayers are going to tear down the new ideas, the new strategies. But here's what they didn't know about us is that we are not only very creative, we double down on hard work and we double down on listening to our customers. And I think the grit that exists in small towns and the abilities to really find entrepreneurs that are committed to winning. Now, winning maybe takes time, and it is in pivoting and listening and, you know, getting great mentorship, great coaching. Those have been kind of some of the founding principles of building my company, which Small Nation, we invest in places, spaces, and dreams for small towns and entrepreneurs. It started with a pizzeria, but what has grown from that pizzeria is once you got a great destination restaurant, there were other restaurants that wanted to cluster around and be a part of our downtown community. Now, my partner and tenant, Brittany, that owned the pizzeria, I credit her because she had the attitude to want to welcome other restaurants and other food and beverage establishments to our downtown. That is another challenge in many communities. They look at those other businesses as threats when it's actually the very opposite. Those are potential opportunities as you get to be known as a place for dining. More and more people will say, let's go to that downtown. Let's go to that town because I have multiple options that we can eat and drink and have a great night.
So Jason, part of our work at Virginity is helping cities understand that the time, talent, and treasure, as we call it, to transform their community, it often lies within its residents. And local governments can do very simple things to clear the runway for that local and incremental development to thrive, especially as it relates to codes and regulations. So could you share with our listeners some of the challenges that you've encountered as a small developer that can serve as lessons and are things that maybe don't immediately spring to mind either for regulators or small developers?
You know, coming in to Belle Fountain, we were very lucky that some of the community leaders recognized that things probably couldn't get worse, that there was really only one way to go, and that was up. With that said, change is really hard. Every town has different groups and constituencies that kind of operate. I call that there's sometimes a group of good old boys, people that have been around for a long time and typically have a lot of knowledge and experience and money, but oftentimes can be very rigid and not open to change. And that's a problem. There's good things that come from that contingency, but there's also challenges with that. And then you got people that are kind of the hipsters, the nerds, the creatives. Like these are people that have all of these incredible ideas and energy and passion. Typically, they may be younger, but they are another great, sometimes underutilized group in a town. And then you also have the government and the public side that sometimes can be organizations like city council. It can be city administration. It can be chambers of commerce, Main Street tourism. I think what we try to do is bring those groups of people together or even have maybe a representative from those groups and to actually get them talking to get stuff done. Because in those silos, a lot of times things get lost, things get stuck. So when we started revitalizing Belle Fountain, we kind of created a little de facto group called the Illuminati. We would meet, you know, early mornings or late at night, or even sometimes just have a text chat. And signage became really one of the most important things as we were rebuilding the town. And if you would go and look at the city's sign code, I literally think it was one of the largest documents that existed in the ordinances of our community. I couldn't figure out after reading 40 pages if I was allowed to put up a sign or not put up a sign. And for us, in the beginning, we had to actually do some experiments, is what I would call them. We had to break a few rules, even though we didn't know the rules or couldn't interpret the rules. We would do public art projects. And one example that I'll share is that we needed wayfinding signs to highlight businesses that were on some of the side streets in our historic downtown. So there may have been an experiment on a Sunday afternoon. We removed a few bricks from the streetscape. We augured a hole, put up a post, a bag of Quikrete here or there. And Monday morning, we had our beautiful wayfinding sign that had very colorful directional arrows with logos highlighting the amazing businesses on the side streets. I can tell you that Monday, I did get a really angry phone call from the city engineer, reminding me of the zoning code, reminding me that that was completely against every ordinance in town. And then I asked him the question, how long do I have to keep it up? He said 30 days. Well, our Illuminati group started to talk to the business owners that were on that sign. Not only were they getting new business that was walking in, the pedestrian traffic increased, the kind of comments and ideas that I had no idea that that business existed. I am so happy that I had this chance when I ate at the restaurant and walked around the corner and found the boutique, found the craft store or the antique mall. Well, the experiment did so well. If you come to our town today, we have 8 of these wayfinding stations in our historic downtown. And not only that, the funding It's $200 for the plaque for the first annual cost and then $50 a year renewal. That money funds the downtown flower pots. It funds downtown activities. So I'm really proud of that example of understanding that the code was holding us back. You know, sometimes we have to break a few rules, but then work through the official process to actually get the rules changed. And I think in some towns, knowing the stakeholders, the groups, you have to be a little bold. You have to be a little creative. And we use this example for people to come to our town and rip and duplicate and take the wayfinding signage program back home.
Love it. Well, I'm interested in hearing what your thought process is when you're selecting sites and buildings for investment and redevelopment. This is a question we hear a lot. Can you give our listeners some insights into how you approach this?
Well, I think it's depending on the economic kind of life cycle that your town is in. And you may be coming from a community that there is almost zero occupancy, and you may be in a position where you're looking to do some new construction, or you're looking to expand and add additional levels to some of the properties that you have, or you may be in a community that is really struggling and there isn't a lot of entrepreneurial investment life energy in your downtown, and you might even be somewhere in the middle. And I remember thinking back to reading business books of this thing called the product life cycle, and it was kind of this bell curve of, you know, as early adopters, as the economy grew, like there's different phases. But what happens is sometimes your community will be in a down phase, whether it's many of the business owners are at retirement age and there's no one to take them over. Like, I see a lot of those patterns that just happen in towns. Well, let me give you hope, is that if you're not at the top of the curve, that is a great opportunity for investors and people to say, I want to start buying buildings. I want to start businesses because of reasons like affordability, because of access to capital, access to the quality of life that you may have at that time. Investor entrepreneur types typically don't want to come in at the height of the market. We want to come in and add value to improve something. So for me, the first thing I'll do is look at what is the condition of the buildings. Is there value that I can add to that property or to that town or the community? What is also missing? The other thing that we've done, and we share this on our website, is we have broken down. There's a number of business models in every town that we know work. Every town needs a good eclectic mix of restaurants. Every town needs several or a few destination coffee spots. Every town needs a 24-hour fitness facility, hair salons, barbershops, antique malls. So if you go to our website at smallnationstrong.com and you click on the success tab, we have broken down these case studies that you can rip and duplicate and take back to your town. So if you're missing the hair salons, if you're missing the restaurants, if you're missing the great co-working space, those are the kind of things that I look for because we've had experience doing in Bell Fountain. And I know that those same business models and practices with the right renovation, with the right design, with the right operator will work in your town.
Great advice. And I read through some of those fact sheets and they're extraordinary resources. So I'm glad you brought that up. I also noticed on your website, you have a very impressive team of folks with a variety of different backgrounds and expertise. I mean, it's really a carefully curated group of people that come together to do the great work that you all do. And I'm sure that's happened bit by bit over time as you've gained momentum. So to those people that are inspired by your story and are looking to start with that first project in their hometown and they're doing it solo, what advice would you give them to just get started from the very beginning?
For us, it was finding people that felt unappreciated and underappreciated that were kind of peppered throughout small towns in Ohio. And what I found is the amount of creativity, the amount of hustle, drive, passion, it existed. There wasn't someone that was really good at helping the catalyst for the group to come together. And for us here in Bell Fountain, it really has been most of my team members have had experience working in restaurant or hospitality, working in the front of the house or the back of the house. So when we started renovating buildings and working to find tenants, what was awesome about the background that we have, we can speak from experience. We know how to fry wings and to make pizzas. We know how to serve. We know the importance of making guests feel incredible because we know they'll come back again. And so what's somewhat unique about our model is not only are we the developer, the landlord, the equity partner, sometimes the operator, but we're the 911 plan. So especially during COVID, we know, you know, and you see in the national trends of how difficult it was to find labor, how difficult it was to pivot and innovate your business model while being, you know, closed. So we've been in those trenches, and I can speak from experience and give advice to other investors about what a restaurant needs in terms of financial ratios, what their lease payment needs to be, what top line revenue, what expenses, like all those things to be profitable. Because if a small business is not profitable in a town or in a building, and they close after that year lease or that 3 year lease, that does not help sell other small businesses from wanting to come there. So I'd say the biggest thing about building and finding a team is that we have varied skills in operations, marketing, development, construction. It really is kind of building people that really want to see from a holistic standpoint how an entrepreneur who risks incredible amounts of time, family, capital, how when they sacrifice deeply, how they can win and build a great quality of life with their family, with their community, working together.
So it sounds like it really all comes down to having that common core belief and that passion is the underlying kind of common factor. And then building from that, having a variety of different people who believe that they too have something to pitch in. And over time, you get that team that you're putting together. So I think that's excellent advice. And we find when we're working in some of these smaller communities, especially, there's a lot of passion there. It's just, as you very aptly described earlier, people that feel forgotten, that feel discounted. And so I'm really glad that you made that point. You mentioned COVID, so I'm going to talk about that for just a second. So looking back, you know, there's so many lessons that we've learned about resilience, about creative solutions, about creative financing, about small business survival. Can you share some of the lessons that you and your team and maybe other entrepreneurs that you've worked with took away from that time?
You know, in history, from a small business perspective, this has been probably and will be probably one of the most difficult, challenging, inspirational, amazing opportunities. I mean, it's kind of the mixed bag of emotions and experiences. I think for us, though, it has been an incredible amount there's been an incredible amount of growth, growth in our resilience, growth in our ability to innovate. So, you know, we've opened up 2 restaurants during COVID, which is quite a feat. One of them, we had to pivot to a ghost kitchen. And the concept of a ghost kitchen is no physical dining room. Basically, people picking up orders to go and using things like Uber Eats and DoorDash to deliver. So we created a seafood place called Captain Kraken's. And our town did not have any seafood, but the community overwhelmingly supported that during the height of the pandemic. But that also led to us knowing that maybe a seafood place could stand on its own permanently. The other things that I've seen is we were under construction for a shared office and co-working facility in our downtown pre-COVID. That is called Build Co-working Space. And when COVID hit, the demand for having great internet, having places where you could work outside of your home or outside of your company, that was like one of the most timely businesses and needed businesses in every town and neighborhood around the country. And we are expanding now. We have our second location under construction in Marysville, Ohio. We're going to be announcing a third location soon, but that need to having shared co-working office space. And the other inspirational thing is we had a food truck that decided to be the anchor tenant in that co-working space called the Flying Pepper Cantina, because having, you know, this being from Texas, having authentic Mexican food, beautifully curated tacos, margaritas that don't have the mixers and the fillers in it, guac at the table kind of things. We didn't have that in our small town. And being in Ohio, now that we have a destination cantina in the overall co-working facility, that has just been one of the best things for our downtown ecosystem. And the story behind Humberto and Laura that started in a food truck, moved to brick and mortar, and are now successful doing that, those are also the kind of stories that we want to see in other towns around the country. So I'll say that COVID has certainly been challenging, but the upsides that we have seen from it, particularly from when you can live from anywhere, it becomes, what does your town offer in terms of quality of life? The yoga studios, the gyms, the boutiques, the hair salons, the restaurants. So I think for your town, this is the chance to reset and really be that town or that community that you want to be.
Yeah. So to kind of continue on that thread a little bit, you know, you mentioned earlier that there's always naysayers, especially in the beginning of something like this. And, you know, this question that sometimes comes up of, well, why downtown, is one that we hear everywhere. And so, you know, in some of our work with cities, we found that sometimes it takes quite a bit of convincing to get decision makers and residents to prioritize those core neighborhoods and downtowns that date back to the beginning of that community's existence over that suburban style big box and the next big incentive deal, right? What would you say to those that are currently focused on the latter and help them understand why the former is really so important?
Well, in 1987, store number 1187 from Walmart opened up in Bell Fountain, Ohio. That was the first Walmart to come to Ohio. So you imagine my parents were small business owners. I remember them talking around the business table, what are we going to do to compete? How do we have to expand our hours? Do we offer gift wrapping? What do we do to compete against a mass merchandiser? And so the trends to move to the outskirts of town, you know, for us and a lot of the Midwestern communities started then. But what I think has been lost with that is the character, is the walkability, is the history. So when I hope you can visit me in Bell Fountain at some point, AJ, and we do some things that are just, we're proud to like talk about. We are the shortest, the tallest, and the first. And when you come visit, you will get to walk on the world's shortest street. It exists in our town. You'll also get to walk on the first concrete street in America. So there was a pharmacist in our town that took sand, clay, and marl and mixed it together and invented concrete. The other thing is geographically, in a very flat state, Bell Fountain is the highest geographic point. So you got to figure in your town, no matter where you're at, what are the fun, funky, cool, unique things that you can talk about that get other people to say, hey, I want to go take a selfie on that street, or I want to go walk it and then grab a great cup of coffee. And so I think the shopping center outside of town or the mall, they will never have that. They lack the history, the architecture, the character, the walkability. So the pendulum that's swinging back is that downtowns, particularly in those communities that are outside of a lot of the major cities, are some of the new frontier for neighbor and community building and a great ecosystem to start and open businesses.
I love that, the new frontier. And you're right. All of those things you mentioned are so unique and quirky and something you're not going to see anywhere else. And I can't say that I've ever been inspired to visit a place because of their Walgreens or any of their subdivisions where every house looks exactly the same. So you're right on track. And given the food presence and the variety of things you offer, I can tell you I will definitely be visiting, if nothing else, to have a margarita and a taco while I'm there.
So let's talk about that co-working space that you mentioned. I read about this a little bit, and I'll tell you, this has been a really big topic in the wake of COVID-19 for a lot of communities. However, some communities, particularly in rural areas, outside of a larger urbanized location, are somewhat skeptical about the opportunities for them. What perspective would you want to contribute to that conversation, kind of food for thought?
It's important to remember that small towns build great things. And while manufacturing was what really, you know, helped spur the development of towns 100 years ago, it is actually going to be the new wave of businesses with good ideas. And having internet, having affordable internet and affordable office space is immensely important for those ideas to bud. I'd also say that a lot of careers are moving to be remote or to hybrid. So, you know, if you have great schools in your area, you have great housing, or maybe there's natural amenities and qualities with great park systems or near the beach or near the mountains, having that place that people can get out of their home to work, to connect, we will always want to be able to be connected to people. And there's an energy that kind of comes from that. And so I think companies are moving more to this hybrid model, but they're also looking to say, if we don't want to pay for someone to outfit a home office, or maybe the home office is not compatible for the family, we want to find a facility or a venue or a place that people can work. And for us, we already had that, you know, building out the ecosystem. We had the gyms, we had the coffee shops, we had the restaurants, but what we were missing is the coffee shops got really busy. The internet wasn't so great. The noise was a problem. And so by having the co-working facility and walking distance of those amenities, not only did it add a tremendous amount of value to our downtown overall ecosystem, but the business model proved to be successful. You know, we took a building that was about 8,000 square feet, invested about $1 million in renovating all three floors. There are junior office suites, there are dedicated desks, there are monthly memberships. We are nearly at capacity to 100. We're 140 members out of 150 member cap at $99 a month. The dedicated desk, we've got 8 of them. We've only got 2 remaining, and all of the lockable private offices in the building are rented. And so I'm here to tell you the confidence in that business model is working very well for me as an investor. But the bigger benefit and value is actually the kind of people that are now in our downtown that maybe start a business in the co-working facility, but then they want to incubate out to a larger mm-hmm. space. And then they have their families here. They're planting roots here. They're getting engaged in the nonprofits and in the community. That is a win-win-win.
So you mentioned something I want to follow up on, and that's your focus on the downtown there in Belle Fountain as a greater ecosystem. I think sometimes where people miss out on downtown revitalization that has lasting value is this tendency to be very siloed within their own projects and not think about this larger ecosystem. How do you maintain that community of people that you've built and make sure that they are always staying plugged in and connected with one another to keep that lasting value?
I know, I'm going to be honest, it's not easy, because you'll find there are just entrepreneurs in general are creative, they're ambitious, they're competitive, they're busy. And I think that's the other thing is, you do need governance in a town. The Chamber of Commerce serves a very valuable purpose. The Main Street, if you have those groups, that's very valuable. But in the same light, you need to find people that you just resonate with. And that may be a much smaller tribe that you get activated to do projects together. You share leads and referrals. You do combined marketing. I will say it's very hard to do the kumbaya and to get 100% unanimous agreement on anything. But if you can get a group of people that has a vision, has a plan, is working with community partners to get it done, I think you're doing a lot of things right. And I probably say that's more, you know, we operate a for-profit business We buy buildings, we lease spaces, we provide capital, we sometimes become equity partners with some of the businesses. So there are going to be other businesses that aren't our tenants or aren't our business partners. We want them to win too, but you know, there is the nature of fighting sometimes. How do you deal with inequalities that come up? And I think that's why the chamber exists. That's why there are membership opportunities. There are ways that those groups can represent more holistically instead of just the landlords or the building owners in town. But I'm here to tell you, like, I think that it can be done. What we found in the beginning, it was, if I could find four or five people that were willing to not only have a good idea, but actually work to implement it and get it done, those are the four to five people that I want to hang out with and accomplish and do things, good things together.
Absolutely. Well, one other thing I want to make sure that you tell us a little bit about, because I think it's a really interesting idea, is your hometown opportunity platform. What's the premise and how does it support kind of the small nation philosophy that we've talked about today?
Well, now more than ever, being able to recruit talent and maintain a really solid workforce is really now issue number one. You know, what we've found, especially in smaller markets, is that it's very difficult sometimes to find out what jobs exist in that market and also what candidates may be looking. And we saw a disconnect, this has been about 11 years ago, when Monster, LinkedIn, Indeed, you know, all of these different services were out there. But if you were in a smaller market outside of the big city, you would look at those jobs or you would look at those candidates, and whoever was spending the most money on advertising, and most times it was the big company in the big city, that's who was being noticed. That's who was, you know, that's the jobs that you would see. So we created a platform really diving down, and it's a software that can be implemented on the local level. Oftentimes it's economic development chamber, or it's led by the city or county. But it allows companies to create their own profile to highlight why it's unique, interesting, why the jobs at that company are what they're like. You can see a video, you can see pictures, you can view their website, but you can also see all of the available job postings that company has. The same is true of getting into the schools and really understanding for students, you know, what does their career path look like? And are they aware of the great local employers in the area, in the region, that and what they're paying and what training that they offer? That has been a game changer of getting that group of stakeholders involved. And then there's a lot of folks that are thinking about, maybe they lived in a big city or they lived out of state and they miss their family, their school, their church, and they're ready to maybe move back home. And so that's kind of how the name Hometown Opportunity came about. But it's basically a jobs platform posting board that allow users that are looking for jobs to enter their information, to become a part of the database, and to get updates by email or through the app of what jobs are coming available with industries that they're interested in. And also, they can upload their own resume if they're searching for a job, where the champion of that software can be like a matchmaker, meaning like, I read your resume and you have all these incredible gifts in graphic design and you understand computer programming. Are you aware of this company and this job that's opening? Can I do an introduction between you two? So if you think like a personal matchmaking service for employers that have jobs and those looking for jobs at a hyper-local level, that is what the product is. And we've had tremendous success with it. We've implemented it in about 18 counties here in Ohio, several counties in Indiana. We're now expanding to New Jersey. We have a community that's in the state of New Jersey that's using it. So just excited to take this platform and really expand it and grow it around the country.
Well, I hope that we see it in Texas soon. I think it's a great, great tool. And it really just encompasses the epitome of that creative small town thinking, where we have to come up with a different way or a different approach to doing things that work for us. And so I wanted to make sure that we let people know about that opportunity. Jason, I could continue this conversation forever. I've loved talking with you. I will definitely be coming to visit, so don't be surprised when you hear from me. But it is time to wrap up another episode of Go Cultivate. Thank you for sharing your inspiring work with our listeners, and keep up the excellent work.
Thank you, AJ. We're excited to host you for that visit.
Thank you. Well, everyone, be sure to take a look at our episode show notes, where we've not only shared more information about Jason and the work of Small Nation, but other pieces of motivation that you can use and take a deeper dive on this topic and turn around and use it in the places that you call home. So with that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks again, Jason. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. So there you go. AJ, you said it in the intro. You covered a lot of ground in a short amount of time. I found it a very easy listen to get through. Great interview and back and forth discussion. And he's a great storyteller. You know, yes. He's telling his own story, but man, it was very easy to put myself in his shoes of what he was feeling. And you know, what we've heard from so many small towns that we've worked with or interacted with in our work of, what do I do when my place is dying? And I don't want to move. I don't want to have to move. I want to stay here. Or maybe you're a small town that just isn't growing. And how do you create some of that environment for yourself? It was very easy to kind of sympathize with his position, think about so many other places that are in that same spot. And there was nothing in his story that said, oh, we went out and got funding from here or there, or relied on somebody else to do it. It was all about, we're going to do it ourselves. We're going to do it one step at a time. I love the Illuminati. Mm-hmm. that was a nice yes. little. And I did want to ask you, AJ, like that in particular, why is it so necessary? Why do we hear over and over in these communities that, number one, people look at the codes, you know, the average person looks at a code and says, I want to do something, but I can't understand this 80 pages of gobbledygook. And then why does it ultimately end up at this place where people have to go underground, they have to go tactical, they got to go at night to go do something? What can we do to change that dynamic?
I think it all comes back to our purpose when we're creating these tools in cities. I think very often in my experience, what I've seen is cities are approaching this as an exercise of legalities, and they're trying to prevent and head off at the pass bad things that could happen. And you get stuck in that frame of reference. And unfortunately, that is a very different mindset than a mindset of creation and iteration and innovation and all of these things that unfortunately have to find an outlet through means that are, as you said, kind of, you know, behind closed doors under the cover of night. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of sad that innovation has to find dark corners within which to work. But I think that that's a direct product of communities not going into these exercises with the primary goal of making sure that they're creating a framework within which to reinvigorate their community and inspire people to try new things. And if you don't start with that mindset, it's very, very difficult to align the final outcome with that type of philosophy. So you really have to have a very strong philosophical stance. And that's something that Jason and his team do very well. It's not something that seems terribly intuitive for a lot of communities. They see their roles as being there from an enforcement and preventative measure. Yeah. But, you know, I think it's time for us to change with the times. That's a very antiquated approach. You can be more nimble with modifications and changes that need to respond to bad situations. But, you know, government is sometimes in the role of gotcha. It's one of the professions where every day of every week and every hour of every day, someone's questioning what you did and why, and was it the right decision? And there's lots of Monday morning quarterbacking going on. And unfortunately, it's hard to really do anything but see innovation be stifled in that kind of environment. So it's very much a culture shift.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, it's, you think about the planning work that we do and how cities have evolved today of there's the big picture things that long range planning and infrastructure planning, and how do we get our roads sized the right way? And these big, big things that we've gotten in this place of like our cities and our local governments need to plan and organize to figure out where those need to go and to fund them and to build them. And then you look at the trend now of how do we get more complete neighborhoods or walkable neighborhoods? And there's, you know, if you have the light bulb go off and says, okay, we're down a path, we're too auto-centric, we have too much infrastructure, we need to go back to more of these complete neighborhoods. There's a lot of work that has to happen to make those existing places more complete, whether it's a downtown or a neighborhood. And no city out there has the resources to do all of that themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things here that I know we talk about and we try to encourage communities to do, and Jason said it as well, is just we need to find that middle ground of the people that live in the neighborhood. They know what they need. And they know what they want. They know what's missing, right? And I've heard this from Monty a million times in my work with him, of go, don't do a fancy market study. Just go out yourself and talk to people and say, what is missing? You know, what are you struggling with? This is something that's in the Strong Towns approach, right? You just go out and observe where people are struggling. You do something to address that, and then you repeat it. And I see this huge opportunity for cities. Again, they can get that vision and that mindset and say, here's the principles. Here's what's important. You know, we want to make sure it's safe. We want to make sure, you know, it's inclusive, whatever some of the principles and the goals and the outcomes are. No resident's going to go out there and intentionally screw up their neighborhood. Right. I mean, so how do we find that sweet spot of saying, yeah, we want to move back to complete neighborhoods. We want to move back to a local economy and businesses and things that are closer to our, you know, closer together and more walkable. And we know as a city, we can't do it all ourselves. So how do we create this framework for the locals to build their own neighborhood plan and to execute and test and do as much of that within some guardrails? Like you said, I mean, you don't want to go out and allow a whole bunch of things that are going to happen that are going to jeopardize the health, safety, welfare of people. But I could also argue there's a whole bunch of big projects that we're doing that are doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. So it's a trust thing, right? It's a getting a framework, getting a trust, getting those partnerships in place to work together. And so staff can do their job well and support the residents. I mean, there are some things I would imagine where residents want the support of staff and want to say, hey, what should I do with this? Or what could I do with this? But it is such a mind shift. It's such a change for communities to do it. And as I was listening to this, I was just seeing kind of this Venn diagram in my head of, you know, the fiscal sustainability that we talk about and the, you know, revitalizing existing places, the incremental development stuff that we talk about, the outcome or priority-based budgeting that I just got done talking with Andrew Klein and Shane Kavanaugh about. They're all about local partnerships and improving existing places and leveraging existing resources. And I just, when you look at how most people or most cities operate, it's the exact opposite of those, you know, of that kind of structure.
Very true.
So I guess that begs the question of, again, you know, how do we get this shift that, you know, we know communities need. A lot of communities are acknowledging it themselves. And it's just that big. I think I've heard this with a client the last couple of weeks and talking with them of acknowledging that this is a direction they want to go down, but it's a big shift. It's a big change to think about changing the way you're doing budgeting or relinquishing control to people in a neighborhood to stripe a crosswalk or whatever it may be. As you've done some of this work, are you kind of thinking about the same thing? Do you have any thoughts that are in AJ's mind today on ways that we could help or coach or advise, you know, community leaders on how to take some of these steps that, you know, they want to make, but maybe they're just struggling to figure out where to start?
Well, I mean, it's not anything that's rocket science. You have to start with something today. You have to start with something small, and you have to build on that over and over again. But it really requires a philosophy of a community philosophy as opposed to a me philosophy, an I philosophy. And unfortunately, that permeates too much of what we do. You know, we're too worried about what could go wrong instead of what could go right. And, there's not going to come a time where it's the perfect time to try something like this. So it's really, right. I think, about pushing yourself to do that starting now, and not being another city that adopts plans with lofty goals and ideals that you then completely throw out the window whenever you're putting your toolbox of tools for staff to use together that doesn't align in any way.
Yeah, it's why we use the word cultivate. Of you do this, you do it from, you know, the bottom up. You do it from the local. You know, you grow it over time. You do it incrementally, and it's really try something, see how it goes, measure it. You know, if it works, repeat it. If it didn't work, try something else. And I mean, I think this interview with Jason just really laid out that whole approach of from when he bought the building to talking with the community about what they would like to see in it to the very incremental step that he mentioned about just turning the lights on, right? We've talked mm-hmm. about just the put something in the windows. Don't let the broken up windows or the vacant storefronts, you know, put something there that makes it look like people care and are interested. I loved when he went and talked to the pizza guy from another neighborhood mm-hmm. and found that a lot of the people from Jason's community were driving 45 minutes to this pizza place because they didn't have one local. And he almost, you know, you think about the pizza shop guy. Someone's coming to you. You're busy. You're running a restaurant. You're not thinking about expanding. You're just thinking about, you know, being the best pizza restaurant you can. Somebody comes and basically drops in your lap market research that says, hey, half your customers are coming from a neighborhood 45 minutes away. You could plop another location down there, and it would do well from day one. And oh, by the way, here's a building for you. I mean, right. That's economic development to me.
I agree. What I really liked about that too is, you know, it's a great example of us using a common sense approach to economic development, where it's not about landing the big fish and selling the farm to get the big fish. It's not about spending a lot of money to generate reports that are then convincing to people. I mean, this what he did is something that could be replicated anywhere. And that's the point. We hold ourselves back because we convince ourselves that it's terribly complicated and only certain people with certain levels of expertise can come in and assess the market and tell us what we need. And I'd argue that that's a huge disservice, and that's money down the drain in some instances, because no one is more an expert on your community than the people that live in your community. And so there really is a lot of value to having those conversations locally, and it may not feel as nuanced and on the same type of professional level as the big economic mm-hmm. development approach we're used to seeing. I'd argue it's probably more valid in some cases, because there's actually context. It's not just about facts and figures. And it's the kind of knowledge that money cannot buy, that kind of knowledge. And so anybody listening to this that wanted to explore a similar type of idea in their own community could do that now mm-hmm. without having any of those big intimidating obstacles in their way.
Yeah, I think it reminded me of some of the workshop stuff I've done with Monty, where, and we're still trying to figure out how to connect this into some of the larger planning work that we do. But I'm thinking of the Morgan City workshop in Louisiana that we did a few months ago. And you just go in, and I mean, if it's a neighborhood walk shop, you ask the residents, what are they struggling with? What would they like to see? You talk about solutions for that street or whatever, and off you go. If it's a little bit bigger effort, like we're talking here, it's, you know, what is missing in our downtown? who has talents that maybe, you know, maybe they can make a great pizza, or maybe they've got great barbecue, or maybe they're a candle maker or whatever, to, you know, Monty's butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Just find out people in your local community that have these talents and connect them with the people that have buildings or want to have buildings. A key ingredient is, you know, does tend to be the local banks that help put some of the funding together for these things. But there is absolutely nothing keeping from anybody in any community from going and cultivating your own local economy of just what is missing, and don't rely on a market study to tell you it is or isn't it. You're creating your own market. I mean, you know what market is there, and find the people that can deliver something right now or tomorrow, whether it's a pop-up shop or a building or what have you. The funny part, or the ironic part about it, is that's what more people want anyway. They don't want the Chili's or the right. Applebee's, right? They want the local place that maybe it's not the A+, you know, best food out there, but sometimes it actually can be, like in the case of the pizza shop. So, I would, just to wrap us up here. I mean, I think that's it. If you're someone in a community that is looking around saying, hey, you know, what's happening in my neighborhood? There's nothing to do. There's nowhere to eat. Or we need more. Don't rely on your community to go bring it to you. Go follow exactly what Jason laid out in this. Go back and listen to some of the ones that the podcasts I've done with Monty. You can go do this yourself. And it's going to be the economic development strategy of the future, is, you know, and the neighborhood planning strategy of the future, and the community engagement strategy of the future, is put neighborhoods back in the hands of the people that live there, and communities, city leaders just become facilitators, supporters, and you know, stop trying to, like you said, AJ, you know, prevent things from happening, and look for ways to say yes, or say no, but, or no, and, there's always better ways to do things, and the people locally tend to know what those what those are, or can help you figure out what they are. So, really, really great interview. It's one, you know, go listen to once, probably go back and listen to again, take some notes. And I know we'll link up everything in the show notes. AJ, like you said, of the resources to get to Jason's organization, Small Nation. Just another great resource for our listeners, and anybody on the city side that's trying to build better communities, and anybody that's living in a community that wants to make your place a little bit better. So, that's it for this episode. We got some more good ones, coming up over the next few months. If you've got any comments for us, podcast@verdunity.com is where you can send those. If you would like to see a follow-up conversation with Jason or any of our other guests, that's always the best place to get them to us. We appreciate all of you guys that are listening and sharing and continuing to see this podcast to grow. So thanks again for listening to another episode, and we will see you again soon. Have a good day,
everyone. You too.